Hello, welcome to Book Week and happy Book Week Scotland. I'm Sasha de Boyle, and today we're going to be talking about this year's Man Booker Prize winning novel called The Narrow Road to the Deep North by Richard Flanagan. Crisscrossing time and multiple viewpoints, The Narrow Road lets us walk alongside Dorrigo Evans as he works on The Line, the Burma death railway on which over 16,000 soldiers perished during the Great War. The book is dense and impactful, filled with intense detail about the daily suffering endured by the prisoners of war and the impact that suffering had on their lives afterwards. Helping us to decide whether The Narrow Road deserves the praise it's been receiving are literature manager at Creative Scotland, Jenny Niven, and former Booker Prize judge and literary critic, Stuart Kelly. What were your first impressions of the book?
Given how much I loved Gould's Book of Fish, I found this a very, very peculiar novel. It seemed to me more like a series of Carver-esque short stories with some plot shoehorned in at the end. Parts of it I thought were absolutely brilliant. I've rarely read a book in which I loved the pages but not the chapters.
I loved it. I find it hard to read anything by Richard Flanagan and not be blinded by him. I just love his writing so much. I also loved Gould's Book of Fish. I think that's his best book.
Yeah.
I think it's, even my love for this Narrow Road to the Deep North notwithstanding, I still think Gould's Book of Fish is a better book. But I really enjoyed this, and I was willing to forgive some of the structural things for the sort of overall power and the kind of major thing that comes out of it for me, as does with most of Richard Flanagan's writing, is his humanity.
Well, I mean, there are moments in this book which I will never forget, but it seemed to me to have a terrible case of plotitis, that right at the end you felt you had some shoehorned plot put into it. The whole Amy narrative, the whole question about who one of the characters turns out to be, seemed to me to be rather rushed and rather insignificant compared to how beautifully he did the sequences about the Siam Railway, you know, which were utterly horrific.
I agree with that. And that final piece of plot reveal, piece of how many plosives can you have in a podcast? That final piece of plot reveal, I think, almost felt redundant because there was so much other richness, and that felt like an unnecessary cherry on the top.
It was almost like he didn't have the confidence of his own work here. You know, I'd have rather seen the book just being about the Siam Railway and that utter inexplicable hell.
Yeah, because it sort of tries to put that hell into context. It sort of tries to go, and here's a reason, and here's a reason, and here's a thing that surrounds it, when in actual fact, I think it probably would have been stronger to sort of not even give it a beginning and an end. There's a really great bit near the start, and I've totally forgotten the bit, where he talks about looking at the railway and how he could understand each of the pegs, but that what is a line, and it just goes on forever and back and forth. And that, to me, sort of summed up the war bits of the book, and then the rest of it, the romance narrative and the other bits, just sort of sat a bit funny with me.
The whole thing with Dorrigo's persistent adultery after the war, I couldn't quite understand what Flanagan was trying to convey with that.
Yeah.
We know that this man is broken. We know that he is brutalised by what he's had to do. But why that has to turn into basically being a bit of an old sleaze.
But the thing is he was a bit of an old sleaze before he even went to the war. I mean, there are things dropped. There's the bit where he sees his brother with Mrs. Jackie Maguire at the start, and he's already, you know, adulterous at the start of the book. So it's not like he changes massively. He just goes back and he talks about marriage and career as things that he felt a sense of duty towards, but he didn't fully understand. So there didn't seem to be a lot of growth there either. It wasn't like this has impacted him and then this is how he acts.
Well, in a way, the interesting comparison here is Eric Lomax's The Railway Man, which is the non-fiction version of this, which was very much about the transformational nature of forgiveness, whereas this book didn't seem to be about forgiveness. In a way, what was most impressive to me was the depiction of the Japanese characters and how they had a rationale, how they had a reason, how they had a motivation for doing some of the most ghastly things.
There's so many things I want to pick up in all of that.
Crack on.
Firstly, I think the Dorrigo, the explanation. So he's in effect our central character, and we chart the war through his perspective in the main. And we also see the futility of war from his perspective. And we also see the transformational effect on the individual and the relationships around him. And within that whole matrix, I find it entirely plausible that he would be somebody who was rushed into a relationship that he was too young to understand the kind of ramifications of. Then he meets somebody else, falls in love for the first time. They're separated at this epic moment of right before he's shipped off to war. And then when he comes back, he's got a foot in it. None of those camps. He's no longer part of the original relationship. He's alienated from his marriage. He's trying to recover a lost youth. In fact, I think it's more of a sad old cliche than it is a baffling character direction, I suppose. I think that's entirely plausible in some ways. In terms of the Japanese characters, yeah, I think that one of the terrifying things about the depiction of the war throughout is that certainty that he lends Namakuro. In particular, the strength of purpose he has in the Emperor, and when we begin to see that even be unpicked and unfurled a tiny little bit towards the end, it's absolutely kind of thrilling in a way, in a terrible way, you know, just to see that certainty of purpose just begin to unravel in the smallest of ways. That's where the humanity is. I just found it extraordinary the way he wrote those sections.
Again, it's very like Lomax, the translator who tortured him so brutally, became a Buddhist monk at the end of it. And, you know, you can see the same way in which it's limned in this book. Mm. But, you know, just the utter horrific brutality of it. You know, the number of times that words like slime and shit are just there.
It's so visceral, isn't it?
It's absolutely visceral.
I was trying to describe it to my girlfriend at home, and I was just like, it's pretty harsh. Like, you learn a lot about, you know, what a body goes through in that sort of situation. And it's quite, you're just like, I don't know if I could withstand that.
I think that's a huge line of inquiry for the novel as well, about the kind of the male body and the effect of war and all of and the number of times you see it reduced in so many different ways, and the way people respond to their own bodies, and the character Tiny, is it?
Yeah.
Who have these very kind of strong images of what their body should be able to do for them, and how that is all unpacked and unraveled. I found all that side of it utterly fascinating too.
Yes, and the way in which there is such a concentration on the buttocks.
Right.
I was going to bring that up. I was going to be like, there are a lot of butts in this.
Yes.
But, you know, it's a human reduced to nothing but a gap between a mouth and a backside.
And people literally exposed on so many levels. Yeah. It was so horrific. And in some ways, I think that explains some of the structural issues with the novel too. Many times where I felt I really needed to be released from those camps and to read something else and to have to go back in chapter after chapter, that actually told me in another way, that illustrated the hell in another way. You know, you couldn't, as a reader, escape it the same way that these men couldn't as soldiers. So in some ways, it seems to maybe have slightly brutal treatment of your reader, but the effect was quite powerful.
What I found interesting was that because it was so unrelenting, that at times I did start to glass it over in that way that, they describe the prisoners doing during a particularly horrific beating, where they're like, oh, I'm just going to, you know, play with my hands or think of something nice. And I was like, great, okay, more torture. Oh dear, more torture. And just slipped through the grim bits because it was really, really grim. And it is sort of that way that you try and categorize and make neat and make dealable with something.
And you
so
become
horrific.
Inured to it almost because you see it so readily. Yeah, that's really interesting.
I mean, in some ways, I was curious that one of the reviews of Flanagan's novel compared it to Bolano's 2666.
I saw that, yeah.
And, you know, that section in Bolano where you have the unremitting misogyny of the way that women are treated in Mexico and murdered, I found that even more powerful than here. I mean, here, it was kind of, we know that white guys can be brave.
I know, I was like, what is this in service of? That was my question.
Well, there's another angle to all of that too, I think, which is the concept of mateship in Australia, which I'm not sure if
that's interesting.
There's a whole narrative in Australian culture about mateship and about how the role that this kind of solidarity and comradeliness has played in the, not just directly in the armed forces, but in the debate that society has about war in general, and how it's very difficult, as it's played out in the US too or anywhere, it's very difficult to criticize war when the veterans are standing right in front of you, and there's this mateship that kind of hangs all of that together. And mateship is a really loaded term in Australia, and it comes out a few times in this book. And I think that he's commentating on that as well, and about how it's difficult to sort of see your way through that in some ways. And there's a really interesting part close to the end where the group of soldiers post-war and they're back, and they all go to Nicotara's fish shop, which is this place that has featured heavily in the kind of final reminiscences of one of the characters on his deathbed. And the fish shop owner, the chip shop owner, says, when he's trying to understand the relationship between this dead man and the men that are living, he says, oh, he was your cobber, wasn't he? And the author then remarks, you know, he had an unerring instinct for the true language to describe a particular thing, and he specifically says he didn't use the word mate. And I think that's really interesting in there, because it acknowledges that mate can be much, much more problematic, and cobber is just a friend, you know.
He's very good on the difficult distinctions between different kinds of male friendship. I mean, the bit here, Dorrigo Evans is not typical of Australia, and nor are they volunteers from the fringes, slums and shadowlands of their vast country. Drovers, trappers, wharfies, roo shooters, desk jockeys, dingo trappers and shearers. They are bank clerks and teachers, counter johnnies, piners and short price runners, susu survivors, chancers, larrikins, yobs, traymen, crims, boofheads and tough bastards blasted out of a depression that had them growing up in shanties and shacks without electricity, with their old men dead or crippled or maddened by the Great War, and their old women making do on Aspro and Hope, on soldier settlements, in sustenance camps, slums and shanty towns, in a 19th century world that had staggered into the mid-20th century. I mean, that is just brilliant.
Yeah.
It's absolutely brilliant.
He does love a long sentence, doesn't he?
When the fish shop, Mr. Nicotaris finished speaking, the narrator says, the way he said the word, it felt free of the treacherous weight of mate. And it is a treacherous weight. And if you think about that through the novel, about this terrible dependency and the decisions that they make about whether to take a comrade with them or not, and then how you actually have frank conversation about any of that.
We should perhaps mention the sex scenes.
Yes,
which
please.
Are
can
quite,
we please talk about them?
Which
they
are
were
quite
so
bad, I think.
I think I was thinking about it, though, and the stylistically, the way that his writing really suits the moments of extreme horror, because it's really... The word I could think of was granular, because it breaks down every single ordeal that people go through second by second. And he tries to apply that to a sex scene to try and build anticipation. But often a sex scene is about what's not said, and it comes off clunky, because it's like there's one bit where he's like, his hand moved to her wondrous buttock. And then the next sentence is like, she didn't move his hand away. And that like level of detail is just a bit too much for a good sex scene, I think.
They didn't offend me so much as they did you, I don't think. Yeah.
Well, they made me laugh mostly. It has been nominated for a bad sex award.
Has it really?
Yes.
And actually, the scene that they nominated it for, I wasn't offended by any of it.
Wasn't the worst
one.
But
I was, rather, my eyebrow was rather raised. I felt particularly on page 411, where he talks about her breasts longing for liberation.
Yeah.
He's like, really? Really?
I think it brings up quite a good other point, which is the women in the book. And I think that's probably why I had problems with the book more than anything, is that yet again, we have a story about some white guys. And I mean, you know, the things that they went through were very, very difficult. But sometimes I do wish that a story about women would maybe, you know, get a bit more exposure, because the characters are just so sidelined, and they are accessories to the men suffering. You know, they're there for hope, or they're there to break their hearts when they return, or they're there as a way to not think about the war, but they don't often get a lot of traction themselves within the book.
I thought that Ella was rather well done.
At the end, kind
of, at the end of the book, at the beginning of the book, she was cipherish, but by the end of it, there was an angry innocence about her, which I found moving. Whereas the whole Amy plot, I found slightly from central casting. And the whole idea that both of them thought the other was dead.
Yeah.
Slightly. I thought that was...
I mean, I think that her being idealized was again a feature of many of the completely unrealistic relationships between men and women at that time, particularly if they'd come together pre-war and then been separated without really knowing each other. And then they really did build these completely unreal pictures of each other in their heads. They carried around photographs that bore no resemblance
well, that's
to the real
whole thing
person.
With the Mae West.
Exactly. He'd
forgotten what she looks like.
And his drawing of his wife has morphed into this picture of Mae West, and he, by the end of it, is no longer able to tell the difference. I mean, it's so poignant and terrible. Ella is a character I actually, by the end of it, I felt terribly sorry for her, but at the same time, I really respected her because I felt that there was a comment towards the end, admittedly, but that she was no fool, and she, at one particular dinner, let slip that Dorrigo was probably the loneliest man in the world. And she, I think, fully understood the hopelessness of their situation, but also the reasons for her to stay in it too. So I didn't find the women to be particularly two-dimensional. I don't think they were central to the narrative in the present. They often were kind of off-screen, but that bothered me an awful lot less than it does in many, many other books.
I'm sure we could spend the whole afternoon talking about books with that kind of problem.
I think I enjoyed the parts with Ella by the end, but the reason that her character wasn't developed is because she wasn't there. She was referred to. She was just this, weight around Dorrigo's neck, effectively. And it was only when she actually got a scene that you were like, oh, well, yeah, she's quite interesting, really. And I think maybe it would have just been a bit more smooth in terms of her character if we'd had a bit of that at the start. Mm. But then maybe she's meant to be an enigma at the start, like this unknowable society lady.
Well, I mean, the really unknowable female character in it is the prostitute after Hiroshima. I found that exceptionally moving, that his sort of disgust and his horror, you know, he does misogyny very well in some ways.
Yeah.
You know,
he's such a humanist. It's in all of his writing, I think, Richard Flanagan. And I mean, having seen him speak lots of times and done a bit of work with him, and I know he's heavily involved in Australian politics with the Green Party, not directly as part of the party, but he's done so much campaigning on behalf of Indigenous forests and things. He's been really central to Indigenous affairs, particularly in Tasmania, where his family are from. And his brother, Martin Flanagan, is an excellent journalist who has written explicitly about Indigenous people for much of his adult life. And Richard Flanagan is really alert to a lot of that. And in the morning that he won the Booker Prize, in one of the first or second interviews, he managed to slip in that he was ashamed to be Australian because of what Abbott is doing to the environment. Yeah. He's a deeply political man. And that was no small kind of accident that he said that on the morning when he's got the world's attention, you know. I really find myself sort of in alignment with a lot of his politics. And so I'm probably too willing to forgive him.
Tell me, I mean, the aestheticization of violence in it. Mm. There is that one scene where the Japanese are beheading people.
Yeah.
And it talks about the colours inside the body, the yellow of the fat, the pink of the muscle, the red of the blood, the white of the bone. There is a kind of awful beauty that he puts there, which I found myself slightly squirming at. Now, maybe I was supposed to be squirming at that point. You know, there was a sense in which he is writing so beautifully about such ghastly things that you wonder, shouldn't this just be actually slightly starker, slightly less prettified?
It's not a glorification as such, but by kind of making it so beautiful, it's eye-catching in a very uncomfortable way, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I think there's a lot in the book about, and I probably haven't been able to digest it fully on that level yet, but a lot about the purpose of art in all of that, and the reason that, and the only book that anybody reads in the whole camp the entire time is Mein Kampf.
Yeah. And a romance book with the last pages ripped out.
That's, yes, nice cliche that one too.
No ending.
The purpose of art, and there's another quote where Dorrigo is talking to Squizzy, one of the other inmates, and he says, "It's only our faith in illusions that makes life possible, Squizzy," he had explained, in as close to an explanation of himself as he ever offered. And I think that's a really interesting prism to think about the book through too, and about the suspension of disbelief and what you do with your imagination and what the purpose of writing a book like this at this particular time is too. And if you think about our kind of narrative around the First and Second World War, and as we're going into another enormous anniversary, and when in Australia as well, that debate about Anzac and whether it's glorified or whether, you know, what the purpose in that kind of memorialising is. What is the role of art and what do we mean by producing a book like this now? And yeah, I need to ruminate on it all a lot more, but well, I think
it does deal very specifically with the kind of problem that we've known about in the Occident in Europe for a long time, that the very people who were marching people into death camps were listening to Beethoven and Wagner. Now, the fact that the Japanese guards here have such a huge understanding of their poetry and culture, the idea that culture does not make you good.
I like that.
You know, that's a very Bellano kind of thing. And I think that's one of the reasons he's so interesting. He's almost aligned Flanagan with a particular kind of literature, which is predominant at the moment, in which literature distrusts literature.
Sure. Obviously, we've touched on the fact that it won the Booker Prize this year. And I guess my question is, do you think it deserved it? You know, should it have won? Do you think it lived up to it? I know the Booker Prize is a bit woolly in terms of what it awards it for. I looked it up today and it's the best novel in the opinion of the judges, which means it could be a wildly different set of criteria from year to year. And obviously, Stuart, you're fresh from judging last year's Booker, so I thought you might have some thoughts on that.
Well, yes, I mean, it is always a very strange thing that it's a very simple rule that's very complicated. Mm-hmm. And when we were judging the Booker, the first thing we did was try to understand amongst ourselves what we thought the rule meant. Mm-hmm. You know, what does best mean? Are you going for ambition or accomplishment? Mm-hmm. Are you going for perfection or daring? And, you know, these are all different kinds of bests. There isn't one best.
Yeah, best is such a woolly term to use for something like that.
You know, it seems to be singular and yet it has to be plural. Now, if in a certain year people decide that they think what should be rewarded is the perfection rather than the ambition, they'd rather have something which was, you know, my preference was always for raggedy brilliance over thin beauty.
Yeah, same.
You know, but each year it's up to the judges to make that decision. Now, in terms of this year's Booker, I was exceptionally surprised that some books didn't get through to the shortlist stage. I would have said that the David Mitchell...
I was just thinking, Bone Clocks. Yeah.
The Bone Clocks was wonderful. Well, Will Self's Shark, I thought, should have been on it. In terms of... I mean, this was the first year with the prize being opened to not just Commonwealth and Irish writers. I was surprised at the American selection, I have to say. I thought there was some better American literature out there this year. Jonathan Lethem's Dissident Gardens, for example, I thought wasn't a shoo-in, but I thought, you know, that's a very, very ambitious, clever novel. The one for next year really is Marilyn Robinson.
If
Lila isn't on the shortlist, okay, I will actually emigrate and just become French.
Get down to the bookies now, place your bets.
But, you know, it is difficult. You have to formalise in yourself what it is you think you're doing. And if you don't do that, you get a kind of haphazard and incoherent long list and short list. When you're judging the Booker Prize, you will have read the winner 3 times.
Right.
And rereading is such a different experience from reading. I mean, that's the one thing that I found. That for me was the whole point of the Booker. Can this book survive 3 readings? Now,
of that particular panel, which is
that me. Is the question I was thinking.
To be perfectly honest with the Flanagan, I don't think I would go back to it.
That's interesting.
In the book itself, the book talks about books quite a lot. It's one of the things that came up again and again, is there's little nuggets and quotes about books and the power of reading and the function of reading. And there's a bit where it said, a good book makes you want to reread the book and a great book makes you want to reread your soul, which I thought was, you know, a little hackneyed.
What it did make me want to reread was Flanagan's other work. You know, I will go back and reread Gould's Book of Fish, certainly. I doubt I will reread this one. In a way, the kind of moral sentiment behind it, you know, war is bad. Well, you know, actually,
knew that.
I kind of knew that.
I think that's a terrible oversimplification, though. War is bad. Come on.
Well, actually, in a way, what the book says, which is more challenging, is war is good. That actually these people find themselves as warriors.
But to what end? They come back and then their lives, you know, kind of... I think it's really deeply sad in many of the conclusions to the stories.
I think that's a good point, though. Like, the only thing that some of them are truly good at is that sort of instinct that they picked up in the jungle. For example, Dorigo, like, he has a completely unfulfilling life where he's really stressed out, but people continuously laud him.
Just think that he writes people in such a lucid, eye-watering sort of way that perhaps I would reread, maybe not start to finish, but I will go back and just kind of ruminate on passages of that, I think.
There's certainly one passage which is almost exactly midway through the book where he writes, for an instant he thought he grasped the truth of a terrifying world in which one could not escape horror, in which violence was eternal, the great and only verity, greater than the civilizations it created, greater than any god man worshipped, for it was the only one true god. It was as if man existed only to transmit violence to ensure its domain is eternal. For the world did not change. This violence had always existed and would never be eradicated. Men would die under the boot and fists and horror of other men until the end of time, and all human history was a history of violence. Mm. Now, you know, that strikes me as almost like a sermon.
Yeah.
It has the beautiful quality of a great sermon.
I want my fiction to do that. Yeah. I want to be pushed to think about these things and to have those questions sort of still haunting me while I've closed to the particular chapter that I'm reading and trying to do other things and have that creep into my consciousness. I think that's what it's all about.
Brilliant. Okay. We're just about out of time, sadly. But it was absolutely fantastic to have you both on today.
Thank you very much for coming along.
If anybody listening would like to tell us your thoughts on The Narrow Road to the Deep North, you can let us know on our website at scottishbooktrust.com, on Twitter at scottishbktrust, or on our Facebook page. Also, please tune in about 2 weeks' time when Ryan Van Winkle will be back with our latest wodge of author interviews. And then after that, we'll be waiting till the new year, and then we'll be back with non-fiction. We'll be talking about Cheryl Strayed's book, Wild. And last of all, remember to check in on all ways to get involved with Book Week Scotland, which is happening this week, online at bookweekscotland.com. So thanks so much to our guests, Stuart and Jenny. And thanks for listening, and happy reading.